All right. Hey, as I'm getting set up, just want to let you know, Wendy and I want to thank you for all of your prayers and support of us over 2.5 years. Next Saturday, we will be officially adopting Joshua. So, yeah. Total God thing, and we're super thankful. So, just want to seriously thank you guys all for your prayers and support of us the whole time. It's pretty cool. Really cool. So I got something I want you to start out with. It's on your table. Let me explain it to you real quick before you pick it up. It is this. There's a survey, and I intentionally did not give you like a ton of directions. It's really simple. It's basically just you answer, let me see it just real quick. Are these things wrong? Okay? Just simple. Are they wrong? Go through. Yes, no, maybe. Is there an absolute truth for it? The things below there? It's just your opinion, what you think. Is it wrong? Is it true? Don't share with your neighbor. Do it by yourself. There's a reason for this. Go ahead. This is a question I don't want you to discuss this at your table. I just want you to think about this as we're kind of talking about this. Do you believe that there is a God outside of time and space who has given us a standard of morality? And I want you to think about why would you believe that or not. Do you believe there is a God outside of time and space who has given us a standard of morality or a standard of truth? So, it's interesting, you took that survey just a couple minutes ago, and you, without knowing it, said there is a standard of truth. Whether you answered if something is right or wrong, is there a standard of truth or something? You are, whether you realize it or not, you're saying there is a standard of truth out there. But then it's funny, like discussing it at tables, is all of a sudden it's like, well, do I believe there's a standard of truth? Do I not believe? And this is something that we need to think about. This is something that's important whether you realize it or not, and the Bible actually talks a lot about this. So, today I'm going to be sort of talking to you about what I would call moral relativism, and who thinks, and I will give you if you can get the right answer, the answer that I like, let's put it that way, because truth is relative to what I think, I guess. Who can define what moral relativism is? Who thinks they can do it? You get a free trip to the fridge with me afterwards. All right, Jared, he's taking the plunge. You can walk with me to the fridge afterwards, not right now. Afterwards, I like it. All right. It's all right. I'm going to keep going. Sorry. I don't have a specific note sheet for you, but if you want to take notes on the back of that survey I gave you, you're more than welcome to do that. No, they're just for people to answer. There's no collection there. This is how I would define moral relativism. Truth, morality, and ethics are based off of feelings and circumstances. So basically, each person can make up their own truth or what seems right to them. That's what moral relativism is. And Jared, you hit that pretty good. Here's something interesting. I heard this week. There's a ministry called Ligonier Ministries, started by R.C. Sproul, I believe. And every 2 years, they do this thing, what's called the State of Theology. And they send out to about, I think it was like 3,000 people, which is a really good sampling size for a study. And they ask them these different questions or statements, and they're sending it out to evangelicals, people like us that would say, we believe the Bible is completely inerrant, that Jesus is the only way to heaven. Like, that's what someone that's an evangelical would define themselves as, very Bible-based. And the two things that stuck out to me were, they gave this statement, everyone sins a little, but most people are good by nature. Do you agree or disagree? And for the first time ever, it was 52% of evangelicals agree with that. That everyone sins a little, but most people are good by nature. And what I tell those people is, you've never had a child before. That's exactly what I say. second, and you can write down Romans 3, 10 and 12. That's a great verse to refute that. We can go to Romans 6:23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Romans 3:23. God, and then the second one that really stuck out to me is God accepts the worship of all religions, including Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. 51% agree that that is true. Evangelicals. This isn't just anybody. This isn't just any Christians. These are people like you that would say, yeah, I agree with that. That God accepts. And when it says accepts, that it means that they would have a relationship back with God and go to heaven. John 4:24, you can write that down. But there's another verse in the Bible that says, John 14:6, Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. He's not saying, I am one of the ways. I'm one of the truths. I'm one of the lives. No, he's very exclusive there. He says, I'm the only way to heaven. So I just want you to know, this idea of moral relativism is real. It's true. Funny enough, it's always been true. It's not. It's unchanging. The Bible talks about it, you know, 2,000 years ago, and it's still the same today, but it's something that we need to think about in our own lives. So my question is this, is like, just to think about today, why does it matter to have a standard of moral truth? Like, why does that even matter? Why does it matter to believe God has given us a standard of truth that guides us and that we should live by? And I'm going to give you, a really practical example of why we need a standard of truth, okay? Who knows what this is? A level. Yes, it is. You don't have to raise your hand. You can just say that one. So, this is a level. Now, it's interesting. I believe God, when he created this world, he made natural laws. Natural laws are things that, like gravity, the way they always work. That's how he set them in place. They're going to be like that. So I think God was trying to tell us from the beginning, there's a standard of truth, whether it be for morality or be for building buildings. Okay, so let's see how level this stage is. If I don't move, it is actually very level. You can't fully see that. But we have levels, right? You know, I'm very glad that when they built the house that we just bought, that they spent time to level the foundation out. Because here's the thing, it's just true. If the foundation of the house is not level, you know, just at the foundation, it's like, well, it's only off this much. It's not that big of a deal, right? Like, just in the midst of that foundation, it's only off that much. The level's just a little bit off. When all of a sudden you start building on, and all of a sudden, as you keep going, everything is off, and things are off and off and off until the house basically is not on a level foundation, and it will ultimately fall. And so God created this standard of truth for us to have when we build buildings. In the same way, he's saying in the Bible, I've got a standard of truth for you in the Bible that is for your life. It's not what you think. It's not what you always want, but it's good. And it's a standard of truth. And I think God's natural law by this level shows us that we need and we have a standard of truth. So moral relativism is another way to define moral relativism is this. No one knows my needs better than myself. That's kind of what moral relativism is. No one knows my needs better than myself. Therefore, if God's will is different than what I feel, God must be false. I think I got this on the screen. God's truth must then be some humans who are trying to control my will to what they want it to be. So that's ultimately what moral relativism is saying. Yeah, you know, I know my needs better than myself, so I need to define my own truth. Objective moral standards, or what we'd call moral absolutes, are this. This is what I think was cool. Moral absolutes, the truths that we have of morality that do not change, the things that you cited on your survey of what you believe or not believe, those are what I would believe in the Bible would say are moral absolutes. They don't change. They don't change depending on culture or circumstances because God said it's true in his word and he's the God who created us and he sets the standard. So moral absolutes, this objective moral standard that doesn't change by culture, by feelings, by circumstances, are independent of humankind. They're discovered rather than invented by mankind. They're given by God to us. See, we didn't make up morality that cheating is bad, that adultery is wrong. We didn't make that up and then all of a sudden go, oh yeah, God said it's true. No, we discovered it in God's word because he brought it to us, because he is God. So that's important to know. Moral absolutes, moral standards are not made up. We don't think them up. They're discovered. We discover them in God's truth. So, morality is boundaries that were meant to keep us from harm. That's the truth. God says, I'm a good God. I want you to have a good life. He says, I want to set boundaries for you in your life that you can walk in these and find life there instead of finding harm. So how do we know? This is kind of an interesting thing to talk about. How do we know that there is a moral standard given by God? How do we know that? Like, you know, okay, we got the Bible. Let's look at this. We are made in the image of God in Genesis 1. That's what Genesis 1 tells us, that we're made in the image of God and that the law of God is imprinted on our hearts. The moral standard isn't imprinted on our hearts, or we have our conscience. So I'm going to read you this verse. Genesis 1:27. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. So we have this reality that God created us. He created us. And not only are we just some separate kind that he made, we're actually created in the image of God. I can't fully understand that, but what I get is that means I've got something of God in me. I'm in his image. And this then is what Romans 2:14-15 says, "Indeed, when Gentiles who don't have the law, but do by nature things required by the law, they are the law for themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts sometimes accusing them, and at other times defending them." God has given us this conscience. He's written this law on our heart that we feel wronged by people. When people betray us, when they talk behind our back, when they lie to us, why are we all of a sudden hurt by that? It's because God's written his law on our hearts that we know that's wrong. But then you know what's funny is when it benefits us to lie, to cheat, to steal, to talk behind someone's back, all of a sudden we're able to kind of twist the truth to make it what we want it to be. But when it's against us, we are showing that God's law, his conscience, is written on our heart. Why? Because we're made in his image. Because we're made in his image, then we have the law written in our hearts because God is the one that created it. So then we got to know, well, what is God's law? What's his moral standard? Well, I went the wrong way. Isaiah 6:1-3. I spoke on this, I spoke on it in junior high. Isaiah 6 says, "In the year King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and exalted." He's talking about God's holiness, seated on the throne. "And the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphim, each with six wings. They covered their faces, they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And this is what they were calling to one another: Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is filled with his glory." So God's law, God's standard, he's saying it is holy. He is perfect. He is whole and complete. So we've got to know the character of God. And here's what James says. "Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like the shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created." James is saying here is that God's character doesn't change. While we change truth sometimes to be what we want it to be, he's saying God's character, his truth, never changes. It is unchanging. I think this is cool. How do we know there's a standard given by God? We needed to discover God's truth, not define it for ourselves. This isn't like a new problem, defining truth for ourselves. It's been around forever, but we need to be reminded of it, that we need to discover God's truth, not define it for ourselves. And you know what? I know some people at my table have shared that sometimes truth is determined by your experiences. And that's what it feels like sometimes, that because I experience something, then I think this is the truth. But I want to contradict that and say, no, I still think truth, no matter what our experiences are, as hard as they may be, truth is still truth. And we're meant to discover it. This is what the psalmist said in Psalm 119:18, "Open my eyes that I may see wonderful things in your laws." We need to ask God, say, "God, will you open my eyes to understand your truth?" Maybe even today. Maybe you're sitting at your table going, "Do I really know what truth is? Do I understand it? I got a lot of things coming at me at school and all these different things, wondering what it is." Lord, will you open my eyes to see your truth? So, again, how do we know God's got a moral standard? We can even look at this level right here and know that God said something that is perfectly straight means it is level. He created in nature, and his morality and his standards of truth are defined in the Bible. But we're living in a culture, just like it always has been, we're living in a culture that's hostile to a standard of moral truth. You know, it's easier. It is. It's easier just to fold in and say, "I'm not going to fight. I'll just kind of live to God's holy standard." I hear you. I think that's easier. It's easier to say, "I'll be the Christian on Sunday, but when it comes to other things, when it comes to when nobody's looking, I'll do the thing that's easier." And I'm telling you right now, we live in a culture that's hostile to truth. But God's truth is still real, and it's still good for you and your life. We live in a society that holds to whatever truth feels good, and then if your standard of truth goes against what the overall culture says, and you're considered some hater, and you're some bigot, this makes it hard to live. And you know, we have to learn to have compassion. We have to learn to be able to stand for truth, what God says is true, and at the same time, be compassionate and loving. So as Christians, we're going to have to fight for morality, both in our own lives and for the world around us, to fight for truth in the world around us. So I want you to take a second to answer this at your table. It's this question: do you think Christians are guilty of being moral relativists? Take a couple minutes to answer that at your table. Do you think Christians are guilty of being moral relativists? All right, bringing you back here. We're going to read Isaiah 5, 18 through 30. Okay, I'm going to read it out. I was going to make you stand up, but I won't do that. Isaiah 5, 18 through 21, follow on, man. I want you to read up here. I know it's a lot, but I want to walk all the way through it, and then I'm going to break it down. Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes. To those who say, let God hurry, let him hasten his work so we may see it. The plan of the Holy One of Israel. Let it approach, let it come into view so we may know it. Basically what he's saying there, these are people who are like, I've been doing sinful things. Like I know it's against God's truth, but he hasn't done anything to me. So God, let it come. See what happens. They're kind of cynics. Verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixed drink, who acquit the guilty for a bribe but deny justice to the innocent. Therefore, he kind of goes into this as some of the judgment. Therefore, as a fire lick up straw and dry grass sinks down in the flames. It's like if you've ever seen something that's that dry brush or straw, a fire hits it, it's instantly consumed. So their roots will decay and their flowers blow away like dust, for they have rejected the law of the Lord Almighty and spurned the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the Lord's anger burns against his people. His hands is raised and he strikes them down. The mountains shake and the dead bodies are like refuse in the streets. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the ends of the earth. Here they come swiftly and speedily. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles. Not one of them slumbers or sleeps. Not a belt is loosened at the waist. Not a sandal strap is broken. Their arrows are sharp. All their bows are strung. Their horses' hooves seem like flint. Their chariot wheels like a whirlwind. He's saying here that God's like the people of Israel. This is written to the people of Israel, especially the southern kingdom of Judah. He's saying, because you have said you don't care about God's law, you don't care about his truth, I will send the nations around you to overtake you and to capture you. So in verses 8 through 24, he goes through some different woes and towards the Israelites, and he's calling them out for their sin of moral relativism. They've walked away from God's standard of truth, from his holy way of living. And so I want to kind of walk you through them, and I'll help you understand some of these moral relativism when we go away from what God's standard of truth is. And it's interesting, the word woe, it actually has this idea of an image of a funeral. And what he's saying to the Israelites is, you know, their death, this funeral of being taken over, it's really a tragedy. And it's a tragedy because it's unnecessary. God's like, I had a standard of truth for you that was good. I loved you. I want you to walk. I want to be in relationship with you. But you've walked away from my truth. So the first one is 5, 8 through 10. And what he calls out here in verses 5, 8 through 10, he says, you add house to house. There's no space left. Surely these, I'm actually going back a little bit. We didn't read this, but I'm going back. He's saying, surely the great houses will become desolate. The fine mansions, the 10-acre vineyards. God's calling out the sin of greed. He's calling out the sin of greed here. He's saying, you had it all. You have more than enough, and you continue to be greedy and take what is more than yours. Greed is me getting all I can get. Total self-centeredness. Not thinking of anyone else. I'll give you an example, okay? And I'm very guilty of this. Greed, in a simple way, is this. You know, it's like I had breakfast today, and I'm actually full, and I come, and I see there's that one donut left there on the table. I'm not even hungry, but I want that donut for me. Don't raise your hand if you've ever done that, but 75% of you would raise your hand, especially the guys, right? Because we're greedy. We're just like, it is what it is. We're like, I want that, even though I'm full. I had breakfast this morning. I want that one more donut because I want it for me because I'm greedy. It's just that sometimes it's we're greedy with our time. We're like, I want my time for me. I need my pleasure time. Or I want to do all the things that will build me up. Not God's kingdom, not others around me. That's the sin of greed. And he was calling them out. And theirs is a really materialistic way. And I mean, I think it's a lot of where greed shows itself. But we can be greedy in our time. We can be greedy with our possessions and the things we do. And again, greed is moral relativism because it's saying, I want what's good for me right now. My circumstances, my feelings determine what is true. There might be someone else in here that needs that donut, but I feel like I need it right now more than them. And then he goes in verses 11 through 12, and he says, "What are those who rise early in the morning to run after drinks? They're inflamed with wine, their banquets." And then he says, "They have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of their hands." This is a little different than greed, but it's self-indulgence. It's ignoring God's word, ignoring his law, really for us, ignoring the Holy Spirit to take in all I can on this earth. And what he's saying is, don't you get it? All these things on this earth are going to pass away. God wants us to enjoy pleasure. He wants us to have fun. But he's saying, he's calling him out because he's saying, you guys are all about your own desires, your own passions. You forgot what God desires and what he wants. And he's calling him out for that. It's a sin of pleasure. And you know what? This can be in a lot of different things. And a lot of times they're good things that become bad. But sometimes he's calling them out for being addicted to alcohol and to wine. And he's saying, you're having all these banquets and all these fun parties going on. But you know, the truth is you have no regard for God's deeds. I think video games can fit in this category. I think social media can fit in this. I think sports can fit in this. It's that self-indulgence. Let me indulge in it. To not be caught up in comfort and pleasure is hard. I am there with you guys. To not be caught up in comfort and pleasure is hard. And I'm not denying that. But I have to ask myself the question sometimes. Is God's truth and his will most important to me, or my truth and his feelings most important? And we got to remember the level of truth. Because see, when we just start a little bit, I just want a little bit of my own time. Like, come on, like, you know, and then we keep building up. It's like all of a sudden, you know, it's just a little bit off. It's not a big deal. And then we get 5 years down the road, we made it all about us, and it's off this much, and then it's more. And it's like the foundation continues to be off and off, and we got to remember to stay in line with God's truth. So the next he goes is 18 and 19, he says, "Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness." And he says, "Let God hurry, let them hasten." I talked to you about this a little bit, but this is cynicism. And this is really the underlying attitude of behind self-indulgence. The cynicism pushes humankind, to sin even more, wondering, well, why isn't this great and holy God taking any action against me? Why is it that I've been drinking all through high school, but God, you've done nothing. My parents haven't found out. Are you really going to do anything? Why is it that I've been looking at pornography since I was in middle school, and like no one's found out. I'm doing fine. But I might even sing on the worship team. Like, we start to become cynics. We're like, isn't this great and holy God going to do anything? And God says, you will have your time. You know, I will deal with you. It might be some on this earth you'll be found out. And you know what? If our sin is found out on this earth, that is awesome, because that means God loves us enough that he'd be willing to sanctify us and bring us into his holiness. I had to experience some of that and continue to experience it in my own life. But the cynic says, God, I'll deal with you later because you'll deal with me later. And when we allow the level of truth to be off, we begin to move further and further from his standard of truth. And the people in this verse are saying, I've been greedy. I've been all about my pleasure, but God's done nothing. I'm going to continue in what I do because God doesn't care and he won't do anything. And just in a couple of verses, God calls out the judgment that he had for the Israelites. And so there can be things that we'll experience because of our own sin. And God says, today, come back to me. Come back to my standard of truth. I want you there. Then he goes on in verses 20 through 21. He says this, "What are those who call evil good and good evil? What are those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight?" And this is moral perversion. This is dismissing God. Ultimately, this is dismissing God from the picture altogether. We've said, God, you're out of the picture. I got my own truth, doing my own thing. You know, it's like, it could be, for example, abortion. It's like, sex outside doesn't matter because I can just end it for the sake of convenience, God. You're out of the picture. Who cares what you want? Sexual immorality. It's God taking one of the most pleasurable and greatest gifts ever given, and we cheapen it for something else. It's exchanging God's morality for immorality. It's saying, God, you're out of the picture, so I can cheat because my cheating justifies the end. I'll get good grades and I'll go to the right college and my parents will be happy with me. You know, it's this moral perversion of saying that there's gender can be whatever it wants. And God says, I created man and woman uniquely with special gifts. And culture says, now be whoever you want to be. And God says, but I got a truth. I got a standard of truth that I created that's good. It could be spirituality. Whatever feels right, that's it. Whatever feels right, I want to bring all these different things together. And it's God says, that's not logical. There's only one truth. It cheapens God's holiness. And again, the level is off. And this is the last woe that he gives. It says, woe to those who are hearers of drinking wine and champions and mixing drink, who acquit the guilty for a bribe, but deny justice to the innocent. And it's this question is, am I interested? Do I care about the things that really matter to God? Because at this point, this person, the woe that he's calling out here, they've come to the point where they're saying, who cares about human life? There's no God. No one's created in the image of God. So who cares? We've all but forgotten that every person is made in the image of God. And now everything is about me. It's about me experiencing good, and it's about me getting what I want, whatever feels good to me. There's no truth. Whatever works for me and furthers what I want to do is what is good and what is true. And so as we read these woes, I just want to tell you that God demands, but he wants you to make a choice. He says, I want to be in every part of your life. I want to be in your school. I want to be in your sports. I want to be in your church, your family. I want to be with you in your bedroom. I want to be with you on your smartphone, on your computer, your dreams, your thoughts, your friendships, your sexuality, your dating, your marriage, your job. God says, I want to be in all that. I want to give you the standard of truth to walk in. But will you allow me in? Will you believe that I'm good? And so the judgment, yours and mine's moral relativism, moving from God's holy standard, it says it will have consequences and it will have judgment. And Mark talked about that last week, is that the Israelites were basically experiencing these bitter grapes. God was saying, I created this awesome vineyard for you to enjoy. I created these boundaries, this law, this truth for you, but you wanted to go your own ways. And so now the fruit is bad. So there will be judgment. But I want to take you to a story. It's found in 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 12. And if you don't know, it's okay, but there's a story about this guy in the Bible named David. And it's actually said that David was a man after God's own heart. Kind of interesting, actually encouraging when you think about it, because if you don't know what David did, David was a pretty powerful king, and he had kind of gotten a little bit lazy on doing what God called him to do. So one, he was supposed to be out at war, but instead he's up on his rooftop one night, and the rest of the army is out fighting. He's up on his rooftop enjoying the pleasures of being the king. He looks down at another rooftop and he sees Bathsheba and he thinks, man, she looks really good. I want to be with her. So being a king, he says, get her up here. So she comes up and they end up having sex together and she becomes pregnant. And so what David does is, he's like, okay, I'll fix this truth. I'll fix this, what happened here. This is bad. So what he does is he sends her husband, Uriah. He ends up sending him to the front lines of the battle, not telling him what happened, because he knows if he goes to the front lines, he'll die. And that's what happens. Uriah dies. And so David's thinking, I'm good. I know I messed up, but I covered this lie up, and we're all good here now. And so there's this guy named Nathan, and Nathan's a prophet. And if you've ever got a prophet in your life, you know they're going to call you out on the things you do. And so the Lord sent Nathan to David, and when he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it and grew it up with him and his children. It shared his food, it drank from his cup, it even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. So there's like this one poor guy, he's got this one little lamb, and it's really important to the family. And he says, now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. So this rich man, even though he's got all these different cattle, he says, I don't want to have to kill any of mine to prepare this. I'll go get this poor guy. Who cares about him and his family? So he takes that lamb and he prepares it. And it says this, David burned with anger against the man who said to Nathan, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. Then Nathan said to David, you are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said. I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hands of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arm. I gave you all Israel and Judah. And if all of this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in your own eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. He's saying, you, David, said there's a standard for morality, but you went against it yourself because you believe that truth was relative for what felt good for you at the time. And I am guilty of this, of doing what I think is right. And so ultimately what would happen is that son would die. God would take that son as judgment. And so David ultimately comes humbly back to the Lord. And that's the truth. Is God says, I'm not here to ultimately judge you. If you will come back to me and say, God, I want to take on your truth. Will you forgive me where I have walked away? And the question is, will we submit ourselves that we believe there is a creator God who has a standard of truth for us, that while we may struggle, God, we want to take on your standard of truth and live it out? So let me give you, just as I close here, I want to give you a couple of things, some contemporary significance in a story from my life. And the contemporary significance is really this, like contemporary as in what matters to us right now. Is there any meaning to life outside myself and the meaning I give it? Because a lot of times we're thinking, meaning is only right here, what I get. And so is there a meaning outside of me? Is there a God that is bigger? And so it's this. I'm going to give you a story about my own life. It seems small, but it's true, and it can invade our lives. I mean, I don't know if I've ever told you guys before, but I love coffee. I used to love Dunkin' Donuts, but I got more sophisticated and I went over to Starbucks, and that was a joke. What I used to do was, I haven't done it in a little while because I was convicted about it, but what I would do is, I'm a gold card member. They love me at Starbucks because I spend so much money there. And so what you get when you have a gold card is if you're in the store, you can get a coffee, like a regular coffee, not like a special drink, but just a coffee, and you can you just go and get free refills. They just scan your thing and you get a free refill. Well, what I would do is, in my mind, I would think, I get this coffee, and then I'd like maybe go leave for a while and do a couple of things, and I'd think, Starbucks, you make so much money. I can just walk back in and just act like I've been here all day and then get another refill. I did that for a while, right? So, come on. I mean, I already bought the drink, right? Like, I know it says don't leave the store, but I bought it in Starbucks. You got so much money. And so I'd do that. So I'd go back, and I'd get more. And I was finally convicted about it. It's like, why? Why? It's not worth it. It's breaking God's standard of truth. They said in their rules, and I didn't follow the rules, they said it's only when you're in the store. And it's small, but that's just that little bit of level off on what's next. Because I said, that's not a big deal, God. Why is this other thing a big deal? So all of a sudden, the standard of truth is off. Does anybody remember Napster? Okay, yeah, you got Scott remembers Napster. I mean, the original Napster was all about stealing music. Like, it was the original iTunes. Napster was the original iTunes, right? And it was like, they used to steal music and you could just listen to it. And everybody thought, who cares? It doesn't matter, right? And the standard of truth goes off. What about the fact, this is an interesting thing, that the law of our land says smoking is wrong until you're 18. We don't even think about that. We think, I just smoke my Juul whenever I want, hit the vape up whenever I want, weed. It's all good. Everybody smokes weed. Right? And so the standard of truth, I mean, you laugh about it, but the standard of truth continues to be off. So it could be like for divorce. What's convenient for me? What feels good for me? I thought this was interesting. You think about everyone being made in God's image. There's the rights of people. But we ultimately say, you know what? It doesn't matter. The rights of the unborn, for convenience, we will get rid of their rights. And then it's funny, all the way to the end of elderly people, we say elderly people cost too much. Who ultimately cares about them? It's because we've gotten off of God's standards. Everyone is made in the image of God. We've taken on moral relativism, and God calls it out. And so today, we got to come back to God's truth in his word and say, God, because you are my creator and your truth says so, God, I want to believe it and I want to walk it out, not just to be a good person, because I want to follow you and walk out your truth and be a light in this world. So how do we combat moral relativism? I'm going to give you a couple things I think I got off on my slide. Sorry. Oh, this is a good verse. I forgot about this. If we take on God's truth and his standard, here's what he says. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. And then he says, you are the light of the world. And then he goes down and he says, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. God says, I want you to walk out my standard of truth because I want you to be a light for the world. And it is only by walking out my truth that you can be a light for the world. So here's how we combat moral relativism is this. It's got to begin in our mind. We got to submit to God. I don't have this on the screen. We got to submit to God, his will and his word. We have to give up two things as we submit to God. The first one is we have to give up our right to decide what is right and wrong for ourselves. We have to give up that desire and that need. And the second thing we have to do is we have to give up our right to supply our needs for ourselves. Because this is what happens. We think, well, God, you're not providing for me the way that I want. So I got to twist your truth so that I can get what I want. So as we submit to God and his will, we got to give up two things. Our right to decide what is right and wrong, and our right to supply our needs for ourselves. And in giving up those two things, we're saying, God, I trust you to supply what I need. We got to remember that what I believe affects my actions. I make a decision to believe it and obey it. And ultimately, I can stand for truth. I can stand for God's truth. I can say that I believe this and I live it out. And even if the people around me don't believe it, I can still not believe what they believe and believe God's truth is there, and I can still have compassion for them. Those two things are possible. It is possible to have compassion for people and not believe that they're living out the truth. So we can take on those two things and be the salt of the earth.